Good morning. How is everyone?
Good morning.
Good. How are you? Good morning. Nice deflection, Steve. Thank you. Oh, well, thank you. All right. Well, welcome everyone to Project Church. If you haven't noticed, it's our name on the wall over there as Matt unlocks the notes. Thank you. Caught a bit of a hiring feedback. Might want to be wary of that. All right, well, I'd like to welcome everyone here for the second message in the series that we've entitled Trinity. We got a slide up there somewhere. And last week, Carrie spoke as kind of an intro to the series. The subject of Trinity is kind of awkward in most Christian circles because it's very hard to describe and explain, and you've probably heard it explained several different ways. So last week, we got an intro into it, essentially showcasing that the Trinity is how God wishes to portray himself to us in three different specific aspects, and how it's very hard to explain and better if you search it out yourself. Now, many of you probably had a problem with that last week. We're going to be pushing you to do your own research a lot, because if I sit here and tell you what to think, one, that's me telling you what to think, which is kind of pushy. And two, if I can tell you what to think and you walk out the door and somebody else tells you something different, then now you think what they think. And it's better to think for yourself. So if we push you to go do some research, that's what we're after. And the other thing, most of us speaking, we're speaking about these things because we've had those aha moments. You know, where you're sweeping the floor and then that's what God did. And you want to tell somebody, but you're alone and you're sweeping the floor and it's frustrating because there's nobody to tell. Or you're driving alone in your car. In my case, most of my aha moments happen in my car somewhere on I-49 between Alma and Fayetteville. Have you ever been up that way? There's nothing there. And so it's, I got to tell somebody. Pull over. And they keep on driving as they should. So this week, we're going to start our breakdown of the Trinity. Last week was an intro, but this week we're going to start our breakdown, and I'm going to be covering one aspect. Aspect? There's a joke there. I'm not going to get into it. There's one aspect of the Trinity, the three persons, and that is God the Father, or for simplification, we mostly just say God, but when you hear somebody say God, they're referring to God the Father, not a spirit, not a person on earth, but, you know, what many of us picture incorrectly as the old man in the sky always wearing white. Who? Yeah, Morgan Freeman, thank you. Yes. I knew there was a reason they cast Morgan Freeman. I hope God sounds like Morgan Freeman. That would be awesome. Welcome. How are you doing? Could you please pass the sugar? So, now, if any of you have heard me speak before, you could probably expect me to get into the science aspect of things, but I actually wanted to avoid that this week, and I'll tell you why. If you go through the Bible and you see God portraying himself or describing himself, he doesn't focus on the minutia or the literal, you know, this for that, step one, step two type of thing. He doesn't describe himself what we would call scientifically. He wishes to divulge certain things about himself, certain aspects of his personality, how he wants you to think of him, how he wants you to relate to him. He didn't see science as something to describe himself with. And we know that people, ancient peoples around this time period, did think of such things because you can actually look into Canaanite history. They had astronomy. They had cosmology. They actually had volumes on how they thought the world and the different aspects of Earth came to be. And Israel believed them. Like, if you hear Israel talking about footstools and windows of the sky and stuff like that, they're literally referring you to a science book in Canaan. And you can look it up. If you have a Bible atlas, those are awesome. it will show you this direct connection. They believed in the science of Canaan, but they didn't include that in the Bible. They just trusted something somebody else said and sometimes rewrote it because it didn't jive with who God said he was. Thus, how God described himself is more important than getting into the science of it. That being said, I do want to give you an illustration to teach you how to think about this. If you're ever wondering, how can God exist? Why is God invisible? Why is he not audible? At certain times audible, and when he does show up, it's very strange. Sometimes he shows up at several people. Sometimes the earth is on fire, but it's not on fire. Sometimes a donkey's talking, but it's not the donkey. It's all very, very strange. And that's what I love about the Bible. It's like Greek mythology, okay, they do this thing. That makes sense. But God, if he does anything weird or anything, you know, out of the normal, it's way out of the normal. You know, talking donkeys, pillars of fire, and just, you know, stuff turning to blood for no reason. And it's very weird and so far out there. It shows me we're dealing with something completely unlike anything we've seen. You can't read humanity into God. He does his own thing. But I want to give you a quick illustration, not to theorize how God can exist scientifically, but to actually put your mind in a place where you can be open to it actually being possible in a scientific way. I'm actually going to steal an illustration from the great Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yes, I'm aware of how he feels about Christianity, but that's okay. I'm a big fan anyway. Neil deGrasse Tyson, to illustrate the possibility of higher dimensions in quantum mechanics, as is theorized in string theory, quantum loop theory, you know, a bunch of areas of physics, all of which disagree with each other on how stuff actually happens, but all of them agree that there has to be some sort of higher dimension to house the other dimensions. If you don't know what I'm talking about dimension, it's nothing special. Don't think Star Trek. Certainly do not think Marvel. Forget that. Dimensions, we're talking about actual shape aspects. Length, width, height. That's your three dimensions. And you can technically count time, but I'm not going to talk about that today because that's a whole rabbit hole. Yes, I promised myself I was not going to get in any sort of Marvel copyright anything today. My past two lectures, I always went back to Marvel for some reason, quite not planned, but somehow I got to this. But in my defense, I was going to speak of the term Tesseract, which was a physics term 75 years before Joss Whedon stole it for his movie. And just so you know, this is, well, in the movie it is a Tesseract, but it's not an actual Tesseract. That is a cube. And I'm sure there were several physicists screaming at the cinema screen in 2012 saying, that's not a Tesseract, that's a cube. And it's because it is a geometrical cube. You have length, width, height. That's a three-dimensional cube. But I'm going to describe for you a Tesseract. Now, I want you to picture a point. One point in space. Tip of your finger, just a point. Zero dimensions, no sides. All right, I want to add a dimension to this. So I'm going to make two points. Or, if you will, two sides. And in between those two sides, there's a line. Adding two points gets you one dimension. So I have a line bounded by two points. Now I want to add another dimension. I want two dimensions. So I'm going to draw a square. I'm actually going to have to use this. Thank you, Matt. A square has four sides, each of them a line. So to get two dimensions, I have to have four sides, and they have to be a line, which is the previous dimension object I described. If I want a cube, if I want three dimensions, I have to have six sides, each of them two-dimensional squares, to make one cube. Now, for what we know of, I'm going to go with string theory because that's the most popular, there's added dimensions. An extra dimension would mean if I want to draw a cube in another dimension, and I'm following the trend here, I went from zero sides on one point, two sides on one line, four sides on one square, each of them being a line, six sides on one cube, each of them being a square. So if I'm going to next stage up, I'm going to need eight sides, each of them being a cube. Now, what does that look like? I don't know. We can't describe it because we're down here in 3D, going into 4D. I don't know how to tell you to make an eight-sided object with eight cubes. But the thing is, that is one object made of eight of our normal objects. So the idea of one God being three different entities kind of makes sense if he's above us in complexity. And just letting you know, every single time you go up in a dimension, you go up not multiplicatively, but exponentially. So that's not increasing a volume or increasing information by, oh, times 2, times 10. No, we're talking like an entire universe's worth of information can suddenly be there, and you can't see it because our heads are not made to turn in that direction. Now, why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because we have basically mathematically proven there's stuff about our universe that we can never know. And in fact, if we're correct about higher dimensions, most of our reality is completely hidden from us, and we can never see it. So where could God be? He could potentially be there in a higher dimension. Some of the Christian lecturers and scholars I like to listen to, they believe that God's in a higher dimension and something like that. I personally don't, because of some LIGO detection anomalies that make me question it. However, I still like this illustration because it proves you think you know, but you don't. And I can quote you at least three physicists, all of which I follow on YouTube. I'm a dork, sorry. But all three of these physicists on YouTube, I watched them at any one point in time, they have all said, if you think you understand physics, actual science, you don't. You're most correct when you're okay with being wrong. So, where could God be? There's plenty of room. We don't know half of as much as what we think we do. And the smartest thinkers will admit that. And just to leave you with, speaking of smartest thinkers, C.S. Lewis, in his lecture, The Great Divorce, he was speaking about the first time he actually tried to have a devotional time with God, actually simply talk to God. What he liked to do is he had this, you know, very old home in England, you know, nice varnished walls and banisters and stuff like that. He would find a coat closet, sit a narrow chair in it, he would sit down, close the door, pitch black dark, and pray. And of his time he spent with God, he was referring to trying to escape the closet or feeling like the closet wasn't there anymore. And he had this to say: I got out. I had a sense of being in a larger space, perhaps even a larger sort of space than I'd ever known before, which made the solar system itself seem like an indoor affair. I wanted to share that with you because that was my aha moment. I had just finished studying something in quantum physics, and then I was driving down the road listening to a devotional with C.S. Lewis, and then I hear him speaking of greater spaces, and he knew. How did he know? From praying, no less. Is that connected? I don't know. I'm not here to tell you I know the answers. I'm just here to open up your mind into knowing that you don't know and that there's a lot more possible than you think. Anyway, I shall now move on. So covering this aspect of the Trinity, God the Father, I gave you that quick scientific demonstration just to open you up to the possibilities, but now I want to move into what did God want us to know about him? What did he want us to think of him as? So I started looking into how he portrayed himself in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, you can find several illustrations of God, most of which were directed by him. The first illustration, and I really want you to hang on to this one, God is a purifying fire. And I don't want you to think of like, oh, wispy smoke suddenly filling the building and it's all bright and, you know, Hallmark Movie Channel glorious. No, like he's a purifying, kind of scary fire. In 2 Chronicles 7, and I'm not going to read these passages because they expound upon it, but the illustration is very clear. 2 Chronicles 7, God is described as a fire filling the temple. In Exodus 19, God is smoke on the mountain, and at night that smoke is coming from a fire on the mountain. God regularly also was smoke and fire coming from a tent. In several of, in several of Jeremiah and Daniel's visions, God is seen as, you know, this fiery person executing judgment, which we'll get to that in a minute. It doesn't mean hating on people, just so you know. But God wants us to think of himself as a purifying fire. Now, why was this illustration kind of parked on by God? Why did he want us to think this? Well, picture yourself. You're in this region of the world at this time. You are an agricultural people hanging out in Mesopotamia and the Mediterranean. If you see some land that you wish to grow food on, you have to clear the low-quality plants. In this region of the world, all low-quality plants have one thing in common. They can't hold water very well. Thrush, briars, weeds. If they get too much sun, if they're exposed to fire, they give up their water really quick and they burn off, making way for useful plants. Trees, crops, everything else. If you're also in this region of the world at this time, if you want any sort of tool or instrument, you have to smelt some kind of metal and get the impurities out of it. If you don't, something happens to the metal called porosity. It's the impurities creating bubbles, and the structural integrity of the metal is junk. It will break apart. You will not be able to feed yourself because your tools are all broken. Also, if you wanted anything ornate, you had to expose gold to fire. You had to get rid of the impurities to make it shiny. You have to get rid of the impurities to make it last. If you don't want to die of a disease, you have to expose your food to fire. They did not have any sort of modern cleaning processes. If you wanted it to be clean, you had fire, and that was that. And so God showing up as a fire, you know, you're in this situation, you're stuck in a desert, you know, things seem terrible, fire. We're going to burn out all the bad stuff, and when we get through the other side, it's going to be okay. So that was God's primary illustration of this. Now, walking in tandem with the fire illustration was God being holy. Now, most people, when they hear the word holy, they associate it with a sense of moral righteousness, a high moral code. You know, people can be holy. I think the original writers of Scripture would roll over in their graves, kind of a harsh analogy, I know, if they knew what we were using the word for. Holy is basically singular. Only one thing could be holy, and anything associated with it could be holy, but it's all tied to that one thing, and that one thing was God. Why is God holy? Well, I've heard holy as meaning special, worth praise, to be set apart, which I don't like the to be set apart analogy because that makes me, I don't know why, immediately think of putting a cookie in a napkin and saving it for later. I'm going to save this cookie for later. It's going to be holy. If it's holy, wouldn't it be a donut? Quiet. So I don't like the set-apart explanation of holy. My best description of holy is this: being completely unique and alien to all else around you in a superior way. Now, I want you to go through any of the prophets. I don't even have a specific verse to refer you to. Any of the prophets in the Bible, when God shows up, he is in complete contrast to everything around him, including all the weird angels and creatures that show up. Which, I mean, they show up, they're glistening, they're glorious, they're covered in fire, and then it describes God. He's bigger than them, he's shinier than them. Part of him is just straight up on fire, and he's acting like it's no big deal, literally cool and composed on a throne. I'm thinking of Ezekiel and Jeremiah right now. My favorite description is a guy. He's on a throne chilling, all this sorts of chaos, and there's creatures buzzing around. They're just screaming. They're so excited that he's there. He's not excited they're there. And the impression is, I am so far above everything, I shouldn't even bother being here. But he is. And he's trying to talk to humanity and tell them something. So God being elevated above everything else in a superior way, that's what holy means. Also, and you kind of have to be creative and perceptive to catch this, but God portrays himself as a creative cause. Now, if you look into the mythologies of most ancient peoples in this region of the world, they believe that the world was created from some violent act. God's fighting and then making the world. There are children here, I'm not going to get into details, but yeah, God's fighting and making the world through not nice means. Israel disagreed with that. In Genesis 1, the world is not made as an act of violence. It's made as an act of creativity. Genesis 1, he speaks light into existence like a poet. And that's the literal, I don't have any creative Hebrew words for you, but the actual word for the speaking is poetry. C.S. Lewis fans, it's like the lion singing the world into existence. That's kind of what they were going for there. He sculpts lands and animals and people like an artisan, not a sculptor. Don't go sculptor. Sculptor, it's very specific. Think artisan. I work with any material. I'll use chisels, tools, whatever it takes to make something beautiful. I don't always have to be gentle. And artisans also use fire. So back to the fire again. He sets boundaries in the land like an architect. The sky, you come this far. The ocean, you come this far. He's a planner, scoping out a building. 1 Kings, Deuteronomy, 2 Chronicles, God uproots unwanted plants like a gardener. A lot of people, we hear that, oh, he uproot the nation of such and such and cast them into the flame and now and now. You focus on the, well, that's not nice, but you're missing the illustration. Think, I'm an agricultural person living in the Mediterranean. I hear somebody say, uproot and cast into the fire. When you're clearing a field in this region of the world, you uproot stuff, there's a fire going nearby, and you toss it in. The objective is not, I hate you, weed! Ha! Judgment! No, the objective is, I'm clearing this field. This is going to look good. You're not even paying attention to the weed. The focus is I'm creating something beautiful. It's a creative force. We focus so much on fire and trying to give a negative connotation. It's actually a creative illustration. In Job 10, which I'm sure many of you have heard, this uses this, God is a sculptor, organizing and illustrating people before they're even born. So, looking at all these ways God portrays himself in the Old Testament, I'm to believe he's a powerful, alien, terrifying force, and from the onset of the Bible, and he's working to make something. Yeah, he's a fire, so he's purifying something in the process of making something. He's holy. He's set apart. He knows what he's doing, so he knows how to organize things and get them done. He's a creative cause, a sculptor, an artisan. So, what's he making? What is he working? Why do we have all these creative illustrations? Well, I'll give you the first clues. In the Old Testament came the concept of ritual purity. Excuse me. So if you're familiar with Leviticus, the books of the written law, and all these strange rules, that would be ritual purity. Ran out of my water. Got to use coffee. It's terrible. I'm more fun when I'm caffeinated anyway. It works. So the ritual purity consisted of a law regarding ceremonial cleanness and ceremonial uncleanness. Personally, I would prefer if they said cleanliness and uncleanliness. The extra syllable makes it sound more fun. But this basically meant that touching certain objects could make you unclean, and therefore you're unfit for certain settings. You couldn't go to church, you couldn't go to ceremony, you certainly couldn't go in the temple, and you couldn't go to places affiliated with God in any way. Now, this meant you couldn't touch dead things, you couldn't touch diseased things, you couldn't even touch socially unapproved things. Why? Because if in your culture it's associated with death, you're not supposed to touch it. You couldn't touch anything that was dead or anything even associated with a selfish action because that would make you unclean as well. Now, this all seems strange to us, but Again, they all involve being exposed to something involving death or selfishness. And God is affiliated with life. So these roles made Israel kind of a pageant to the other nations. I'm serving a God of life. Why can't I touch this thing and go in his presence? Well, yeah, imagine touching something diseased and going into his presence. I now have affiliated myself with death, and I'm going to waltz into God's presence, knowing I've done this and not caring. Well, you're not going to survive. Get into why. So, speaking of the temple, the ritual purity that involved someone not being able to get near God while tainted by sin or death, it was not because God straight up wanted to smite them. Again, he's not picking a weed out of the field and then turning to the weed and yelling at it. That would have been a very strange sight in the field. You know, I wouldn't have worked with that farmer if I was another sharecropper. But it's because God's goodness expels death and anyone it's attached to. So what do I mean by this? A good analogy for this would be the sun. So the sun's not bad. It's not bad at all. It's the source for any and all energy responsible for everything that we love, but it can't be approached outright because it will destroy you. Your exposure to it has to be mitigated in order to produce a good product. The earth has to be placed so far away from it, it has to have its own magnetic field to limit exposure, and then you get a good product. The sun's not bad, but the earth too close to the sun is bad. I want you to see this illustration in the temple. Thank you. I am taken aback. I will ask you to give me my back back. Yeah, no take backs if I get my back back. Okay, yeah. You're not supposed to understand. I'm sorry. But so the temple, think of the holiest of holies where they kept the Ark of the Covenant and all that wonderful stuff. That is the sun. And each chamber farther and farther away from the Holy of Holies was compartmentalized to limit exposure to the outside and limit exposure to the people. Not because God was angry and just wanted to take you out, but because getting too close would take you out without his say-so or yours. So how they viewed cleanness and uncleanness, it was, in their minds, it was quite literal. If I touched something bad and walked into God's presence without cleansing myself, that's why I would die. Is because, you know, I touched XYZ. But they also had other rituals to kind of make up for touching this thing. And so the whole point was, I want to enter God's presence in reverence. I want to be with him, so I'm going to take these steps to get there. Now, just touching something and waltzing in and not taking it seriously, you're not serious about getting close to God. You already have selfishness in mind, so that's the kind of person that would just waltz in and not survive. You can tell I'm taking into account the kids. So another good analogy, and I totally, when I heard this last week, said, I'm going to rip that off. Carrie's coffee analogy from last week. If I were only concerned with the impurities in the coffee bean, and I wanted to get rid of the impurities in this coffee bean, I can simply throw the coffee bean in the fire. And it's like, this coffee bean is dirty. That's better. Who would do that? I'm not worried about the impurities in the coffee bean, but if I want to make a good product of some ready-to-drink coffee, I'm going to have to take that bean and manage its exposure to the heat and fire to get a good product. I don't hate a coffee bean. I don't hate the weed from the field. But if I want to get a good product out of it, I'm going to have to expose it to the fire. But I can't just throw it in there because then my product is gone. That is God's relationship with us. The ritual purity and impurity, going through hard times, This exposes what is wrong and what needs to be corrected. That is what God is getting at. Is the fire hot? Yeah. Is it painful? Sure. I don't know how a coffee bean feels. I never asked one. At least not publicly. But if you want a good product, you're going to have to be exposed to the fire, but in a controlled manner. And that was God's intention. Because if he just outright comes down to take care of the impurities, we're going with them. But he wants us. Thus, the entire story of the Bible, all the convoluted thing. Why is he doing this? What's the point? The point is you not being burned. But you have to be exposed to the fire to get a good product. So we have to ride that medium. Don't get burned, but don't be lukewarm and filled with impurity, selfishness. I'm getting ahead of myself. I always do. I figured I would do that. So instead of dealing with our failings outright, God limited our exposure to him and took us through a process where his goodness would transform us into the product he's looking for. Again, what is he looking for? What's this product? Well, I'd like to hit up Isaiah chapter 6. We got a slide for this? Cool. So, in the year that King Uzziah died, you all know the year, I saw the Lord high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were the seraphim, each with six wings, like you do. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Again, fire. "Woe to me," I cried. "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. Is that the end of the slide? Oh, okay. Well, the part that we missed out on, the angel touches Isaiah's lips with the coal and says, "Behold, you have been made clean." Now, I don't need to get ahead of myself. This was a very, very unheard of concept at the time. They lived in a culture of don't touch an unclean thing, it'll get on you. And here, Isaiah was touched by a clean thing, and the cleanness got on him. What? It works the other way? What? That's a big deal. So the burning coal made him pure. Isaiah knew that his uncleanness and proximity to God would get him torched because something about his mouth was associated with sin or death. What was that? I don't know. I don't know if he kissed a dead thing or something. Who knows? But he associated himself with sin or death. A lot of people see that and they're like, "Oh, he was a potty mouth." You've seen Leviticus, I'm sure. There's so many things that could have made your mouth unclean. We simply don't know. But the point is, he knew that, you know, being associated with death and in the presence of God, you were going to get torched. So, instead, he was touched by a coal, and God's purity was transferred to him. The energy of God's fiery presence was mitigated. A small part of it was taken to Isaiah, and instead of impurity being transferred, purity was transferred. Instead of sin being contagious, life was contagious. This, of course, being an allusion to things later. So, like Earth's limited exposure to the sun, the controlled heating of a coffee bean, Isaiah's encounter with God was controlled. God didn't just show up and plant himself in front of Isaiah. "How you doing?" "Oh, we got another prophet around here?" No. Mind you, this was a vision. I must have scrolled over somewhere. No, God's exposure to Isaiah was mitigated. He didn't sit down in front of him and see Isaiah destroyed because he was associated with death in God's presence. He had a coal taken to him. There. Controlled exposure. Now you're okay. Which I'm leaning pretty heavily into this analogy, but it all makes sense in a moment. Try not to get ahead of myself. It's a terrible. Thank you. So, the resulting good product of the whole vision with the coal was a human cleanse of selfishness, cleanse of affiliation with death. God did all the work for the cleansing. So this holy, alien, creative God is out to make something, and he has a creative process transforming raw material, us, into the desired product, a purified human. And if we had Isaiah's understanding, it'd be a human purified of anything affiliated with death or selfishness. So let's talk about the final objective. So, for all the elaborate details of the ritual purity laws, they were abandoned quite quickly by God. God actually told David to his face, David being only the second king of this nation where these laws were established, I care nothing for your sacrifices because your heart is not with me. That tells you we were not being reconciled by all these weird practices and ritual laws. It was what we meant by them. It was our heart God was trying to change, and it failed two generations, and God abandoned this law. These ritual laws were in place to display what kind of God Israel followed and to show what he intended to do. So this transformation was not in the laws of ritual purity. Isaiah's experience with the coal was a vision, and the greater depth of this vision will be covered later in the series, but I'm going to touch on it just a bit. The coal in the prophecies of Isaiah was Jesus. The real objective was spiritual purity. Now I know that sounds like a very loaded moniker. When I say spiritual purity, I don't want you to think of wispy smoke and hocus pocus and, you know, special effects coming in here. No, I want you to think of a change of character. I want you to think of a change of personality. I want you to think of the change of the way you think. Change of heart, if you will. I want you to picture a change where you become a genuinely good person. Who you are as a person has been altered. That's what we're referring to with spiritual purity. Who you are being who God wants you to be. Holy and alien in a superior way to how you deal with life, to how you deal with outside stimuli. Now, Ari said, Jesus was our hot coal. He limited our exposure to the pure goodness of God such that we would not be destroyed, but altered. I find it most useful to view it like this. Every dark thing that happens to you, which nudges you in the direction of, you know, that's better, sticking up for number one and looking after only yourself and the people you're willing to claim, looking out for me and mine, as some people say, that's an unclean object transferring its impurity to you. It transfers its selfishness to you. Jesus, through a brilliant array of puzzles, miracles, speeches, and relationships, he introduced perfect selflessness. Looking out for his enemies, and we saw him do it. It changed us. This point in history, it nudged us. His purity was transferred to us. It nudged us, and in some cases flew us, to being like God the Father. Now, why was Jesus necessary? Why was this so difficult? Well, as we discussed with the whole ritual laws, trying to enact a political or legislative way of organizing a nation such that they themselves became spiritual pure, that they themselves became possessive of an abundance mindset, looking out for other people instead of looking out for only themselves, that was very difficult. I have a passage for you, Ezekiel chapter 28. And just to preface this, I really want to preface this. In Ezekiel chapter 27, this actually caught me off guard when I first read it. In Ezekiel chapter 27, it's literally entitled, A Lament for Tyre. Now, Tyre was a very rich coastal nation in the day of the original exile of Israel. And this lament, I actually was starting to read through it, and, you know, you start off and it's like, oh, it's a pagan nation surrounding Israel. I'm sure God doesn't like them, and, you know, smite them, you know, pull up the weed, yell at it, throw it in the fire. All the other farmers stare at you because you're weird. I thought it was one of those situations. I had the thought that, you know, God is judgment and angry and blah. But I started reading through chapter 27. He goes on and on and on about how beautiful this nation is and how happy he was with it. I'm like, that's not what I was taught in Sunday school. That's not Israel. That's not, what's going on here? He talked about how creative they were. He talked about how vibrant their architecture was. He talked about how strong their workers and how strong their workers were. He talked about how they worked and commissioned with other nations to build things for those nations and for themselves. He talked about how cooperative and welcoming they were, and he actually says in chapter 7, he counted them as righteousness. They were not warring with people around them. They were working with them, and they were not thinking about preserving their own wealth. They were rich. If you were on the coast of the Mediterranean in this time of the world, you would easily be rich if you knew how to sail. Easily. They were rich, and they were sharing, and they cared for other people. People that didn't even belong to the nation, they cared about them. And it's all mentioned in this chapter, and God is lamenting, you were great. You actually looked like what I was trying to build. But then, chapter 28, he's addressing the king of Tyre, and I only got a short little excerpt. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created, till wickedness was found in you. Through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence, and you sinned. So I drove you in disgrace from the mount of God, and I expelled you, guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth and made you a spectacle before your kings. So if you didn't catch the references, there were several things in that verse referring to Genesis 1. The garden. He's speaking of this nation that he did not pick as if they were of the garden. Why? Genesis 1 is kind of a very poetic way of kind of outlining what God wanted to make. And the Garden of Eden was supposed to be an illustration of what he wanted to make. He literally called these people part of the garden and said he cast them out from it. Somehow, some way, and I'm kind of excited about this because I don't know how, because you don't see this too much in the Old Testament, somebody actually doing what God wanted and actually becoming what God wanted to create. Somehow, they became like the garden. They were blameless. And just so you know, when you hear the word blameless in the Bible, that means you don't push around or hurt or kill people that you don't have to, even if you could. And if you were called wicked, it's because you were prone to violence when you saw that you had an advantage on someone. In the many passages where God is pronouncing judgment upon Israel, he's bringing up them neglecting the poor, neglecting the widow. And just so you know, the poor and the widow had zero rights legally in this culture. So how you took care of the poor and the widow was exactly how God would count you, because you didn't have to treat them good for your fellow citizens to count you as righteous. So that's what God looked at. He uses the same terminology here. So we know Tyre was rich and caring for the poor and the widow and the alien. Chapter 27, they always worked with other nations, but then they lost it. Why? Well, it said, in your widespread trade, violence entered. What does that mean? Well, I'm rich and I'm trading, and I see, you know, this nation over here, they're not very well defended. Their navy pales in comparison to mine. I'm just going to go take their stuff, because it'll boost my trade, and it won't down my reputation, because all the other nations around me do the exact same thing. Why not? And that's where we lost it. That's where we needed the hot coal. We needed God to do something that would change our hearts when it touched us. We needed something that when we were exposed to it, it actually gave you an experience that altered your personality, so the next time you encountered a similar situation, you would have a different choice. If you don't see where I'm going here, you probably wouldn't even be aware that you made a different choice based off of the experience you've just been exposed to. I said I wasn't going to get back into science again, but I will real quick. It's called deterministic personality. It's an actual line of physics where causality rules your choices based off of where you've been. So if you have one particular experience, it can change your choices from on out. You know, getting in a car wreck and surviving and appreciating life. That's something like that. You would stop and watch a sunset after that car wreck, whereas beforehand, you would rush off to your meeting. That's what I'm talking about, and that's exactly what Jesus did. One experience that exposes us to an idea that changes our choices from there on out. And we're not even privy to it. Again, getting ahead of myself. I always ruin the reveal. Darn it, Juliet. So, looking at God's reasoning for the ancient downfall of nations and looking at Jesus' mission on earth, there could be no doubt that this holy, fiery, creative Father God is looking to create perfect selflessness in people by transforming us through a controlled process. He knows that laying down the law in a Zeus fashion, thunderbolts, that's a favorite of people, laying down the law in a Zeus fashion would only serve to destroy us, but instead he's patient. He goes through a process. And the best part, and I've kind of already gotten to this, the best part is that Isaiah didn't need to do anything when he was purified in his vision. He didn't do anything outside of panic. Just so you know, panic is like the most uncontrolled state you can be in. So God did not, you know, purify him because he panicked. It's like, oh, you're really losing it. Oh, I like that. Let's purify him. No. God was going to purify him anyway. But he panicked. He was completely at God's behest. No control over the situation. He was done for. Isaiah didn't have to do anything. It was given. The purification had already started without him even knowing so. Jesus has already reached out. C.S. Lewis actually, and I love C.S. Lewis. If you want to know why I like C.S. Lewis and probably why Carrie likes C.S. Lewis so much, it's because you'll begin to research speaking of a biblical concept, or you'll find something cool in reading the Bible or praying to God. You'll just happen upon it. And then later you hear it, you'll see a C.S. Lewis quote where he figured it out in 1936, and nobody else has even bothered with it since. And you're like, well, I thought I was the pioneer. Well, guess not. But C.S. Lewis actually called this the good infection. In his, it's a book called Mere Christianity, but it's a collection of his lectures. But in that book, I'm trying to remember the name of the specific lecture, but it escapes me. In the book, C.S. Lewis is trying to describe salvation to people. And you know, people expect him to say, oh, well, you have to do this thing here and that thing here, and you have to think about this while believing this and saying this. I've literally had it explained to me like that. You have to think about this while believing this and saying this. I'm like, I can't multitask that hard. I am complete tunnel vision. Is there a time delay? Can I schedule a slot? How do you feel about Microsoft Teams meeting? Will you take a Microsoft Teams meeting so we can do the believing in the same? No, C.S. Lewis, when he was asked about describing salvation, he described it like this. Just two words. And for being a man with as large of a vocabulary as his, it's impressive that he just limited himself to two words. Good infection. And he left it. Good infection. Well, what do you have to do? What do you have to think? What do you have to pray? If you were paying attention to Jesus, what he was doing is already in your mind. And it has already changed you. You're already going to think, I should help that lady with her groceries. You're already going to think that. It, no matter how bad the world has been to you, you've now been exposed to selflessness that didn't have to happen. There's no, I don't know if you've seen these crime dramas where, you know, the good cop is trying to convince the bad guy to be a good guy, and it always ends with, no, it's too late for me. You haven't seen what I've seen. The world only works one way, and you gotta take care of yourself. Well, along those lines, if you're exposed to Jesus at all, you're not the guy saying, no, the world only works one way. You've already seen it work a different way. You've already seen selfishness, or selflessness. Even indirectly, you've seen what Jesus has introduced. And it's an infection. And it's slowly moving. Something I would like to point out. Wars aren't popular anymore. As short a time ago as the 1700s, it was perfectly okay to say, we're going to go to war with them because we want their land and their stuff. And it was socially acceptable. It's suddenly socially unacceptable, and it seems like nobody has noticed. It's bad business to go to war anymore. We all know we would already be in several more. Discuss it, I have to add more to that. But we would already be in several more than we are if it was publicly acceptable. But it's publicly unacceptable. Perhaps for the first time in all of human history, it's not cool. Why? Well, what about their soldiers? The Israelites in Jesus' day didn't care about the Roman soldiers. And literally, kind of fun that I brought this up, literally Jesus used the Roman soldiers in his illustrations to love your enemy. It's like in your mind, if you had the advantage on them, you would totally take them out. But I want you to go the extra mile. If you're familiar with that verse, you kind of need some history to know what it means. In Rome, an Israelite was required, at the request of a centurion, to carry all of his equipment 1 mile by law. If he laid his equipment down in front of you, you had to pick it up. And Jesus said, I don't only want you to just comply with that law, I want you to go 2 miles. What? They hate me. They wish to oppress me. If I was found in an alley, this soldier would probably kill me. 2 miles. Love your enemy. Why? It may not work out well for you, but that infection is going to get into them. And next time their commander, or whoever they have to listen to, or whoever they have to be afraid of, tells them to do something unfair and they do it without question, happily, on purpose, when his commander was expecting a kickback, then that commander is going to be thinking about that. And then you have this big, scandalous crucifixion at the center of history, and for some reason, we all remember. He was executed as a common criminal. We shouldn't remember this. Can you name a second person outside of a disciple and Jesus that was crucified? No, they were not remembered. But we remember this guy. Why? Because it was an experience being transferred into our collective memory, and it alters us, and we don't even know. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to do the work. God already has. All you got to do is turn your head and say, I want to be that way. And truthfully, you're saying, I want to be that way because it's already changed you. I could go further into this and say that's why we have stuff like Calvinism versus destiny, but I'm not going to get into that. Very interesting conversations, but I'm going to limit it to what God wants us to know about him. This good infection is going to run its course with or without our say. And we get to participate. But it will go on without us, so there's no need to worry. I've seen this in so many churches. People worried about trying to share Jesus with somebody, and that person doesn't take it. And they're just like, oh, I'm losing sleep over it. It's not up to you. I mean, think of the epochs of history and your influence on it. It's not up to you. It's up to God, and thankfully, because he can cover those epochs. Don't worry about it. There's no need to worry, because it's God's plan. All we have to do is simply to be that which God wanted to create. So, getting back to the Trinity, why did God create this persona of God the Father, and then the Spirit, and then the Son? Well, the Spirit and the Son we're going to cover later. But God created this persona of God the Father to give you a point, to give you a standard, to give you a center around of which you orbit and wish to become like. But he knew that that was too much. He knew that he'd just be throwing the coffee bean into the fire if that's all he gave us. So he gave us the other aspects of himself to mitigate his goodness so that our bad wouldn't take us down with it. He instituted a brilliant process where he would change our hearts without us even knowing, where he would give us a good infection without us even catching it or seeing it, and bring us to him without our impurities. I kind of crossed over into the lecture on Jesus a bit, I'm sure. But God's part is simply the fixed point, what we're wishing to attain, and the goodness that can get rid of our selfishness. So I'm going to ask that the band start to make their way up as I pray. Try to bring us to a time of commitment, and after we have announcements. So, Father, I want to first thank you for your plan, and thank you for your brilliance. Because it's true that none of us are deserving, but you weren't really worried about that. What you wanted was a family. And you sought to create that family and then bring them to you by any means necessary. But the means that were necessary was something that had to be controlled so that we could be with you without destroying ourselves. So I thank you for your creativity, and I thank you for your brilliance. And I recognize you as holy, as above all else. I recognize you as being perfect in love and perfect in understanding. And we just wish to humble ourselves before you now and let you know that you have changed us. And we want you to change us more. We love your plan. We love where we're going. We love where you're taking us. And we thank you for shouldering the weight yourself, because there's no way that we could have done this ourselves. It's in Jesus' name we pray.